Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
This month, we welcome Darren Francis, author of Layla, The Life of Layla Waddle. Darren is a UK-based poet, author, and musician interested in the intersection of media and the esoteric and the strange, conjuring helicopters and allegedly responsible for nefarious transatlantic forays into the shifting of global hegemonic powers. Layla is Darren's first non-fiction title, a biography of the world-renowned violinist and consort of Aleister Crowley, Layla Waddle. Indeed, this is the first time anyone has ever committed to writing an entire book on this fascinating woman of true will. I am your host, Matt Hadfield, and it is with great pleasure that I introduce Darren Francis to the Hadean Press podcast. Hi, Darren. Welcome to the podcast.
Matt, good afternoon. It's afternoon here. It's night where you are, but very good to be here. Thank you for having me.
We're here today to discuss your fantastic new biography, Layla, The Life of Layla Waddle, just published by Hadean Press last month. But before we jump in, could you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in the subject of magic and the occult?
I've primarily in the past been a writer of fiction, and Layla is actually the first non-fiction book I've ever written, so it's quite a learning curve, learning how to write in that way and undertaking the research. And I was teaching myself as I was writing it, if you like, because in the past I've always written fiction, and fiction has always been more my passion. I've been writing from a very early age. For as long as I can remember, and I've already authored 5 novels, and I've also been involved in music a lot in the past, and I've done a number of spoken word with music albums and made music under various identities as well. So I've had a lot of strings to my bow over the years. I've also always had an interest in matters esoteric and occult for as long as I can remember. I mean, going all the way back to my teenage years and even earlier than that. Though it is primarily an academic interest, I'm not currently a practicing occultist or anything like that. My interest is primarily an academic one. And it's funny because the one question everyone always asks whenever you start talking about the occult and you say you're interested in it, people are, does it work? That's the thing everyone wants to know. And I don't know, does it work? I think it can work in the way that something like neuro-linguistic programming can work, in that you can train yourself using these esoteric techniques to think and behave and act in new ways. But even Crowley, who we'll be talking about today, was not so much skeptical, but he did say that people should be very wary of attributing objective reality to anything occult, and that regardless of whatever results one gets in one's rituals, one should be mindful of the fact that they're not necessarily happening in any objective literal sense of demons and the like appearing before you, and in these amazing rituals like it's always portrayed in Hollywood. It doesn't work on that level.
Yeah, he says that in Liber O.
It's Liber O, yes. The quote is in the book. It's don't remember the exact wording of it now, but to the extent that regardless of whatever results one gets, one does need to be very wary of attributing objective reality to any of it.
So this is the first time that anybody has ever written a biography of Layla Waddle, who many of our listeners will recognize as one of Aleister Crowley's Scarlet Women. I think it's awful that she's only been remembered in this capacity, given her overall influence on Thelema. But for those of our listeners who might not be familiar with Layla Waddle and her achievements, could you set the scene for us a little and tell us about this fantastic woman? And what was it that captured your fascination?
Okay. Well, in a nutshell, she was primarily a professional musician, a violinist. That was her main passion and focus in life. But she's also remembered as an occultist and as a lover and muse to the infamous Aleister Crowley. She was born in a small town not far from Sydney in Australia in 1880. She played violin from a very early age, largely self-taught, but she had various tutors as well. At the age of 28 in 1908, she set off from Sydney, England bound, on a musical tour, and didn't actually go back to Australia for another 16 years, playing in England and all over Europe. She did a tour of Russia at one point. She played in America quite extensively as well. And I think she's been rather unsung as a musician in a lot of respects, because obviously what she's most famous for now is her association with Aleister Crowley, which we will talk about in more depth, I'm sure, as we proceed. But she returned to Australia in 1924, having parted ways with Crowley in 1918, at the age of 44, and died very young at the age of 52 in Australia, in Sydney, from uterine cancer. As for what inspired and interested me, in large part, it was initially the photographs which survive of her, which I know you're familiar with. I'm sure a lot of the listeners will be familiar with as well. There are these iconic and rather haunting and atmospheric photographs of her that have survived. In two of which she's playing a violin, and in one of which she's topless with her hands held together and with her hair hanging down low over her breasts. And there's something about those images that's always really intrigued me. In the past, I'd read a lot around Aleister Crowley and the various figures in his life. And I think, regardless of your opinion of Aleister Crowley, and he is very much, I think, one of the, he's kind of the Marmite of occultists in a way, if you like, because people either love him or they hate him. And but it can't be denied that he, in terms of his impact on 20th century occultism and beyond, he's was very possibly the most significant figure in 20th century Western magic. But it was always the women in his story that interested me a lot more, and the peripheral figures in his story. And above them all, for some reason, was always Layla Waddle. And I think it was those photographs that I kept drawing back to and just wondering who this woman was exactly. And from there, I decided to write a biography of her, just because nobody else has done it. And as I began to research her life, I realized that a lot of the details of her life are quite obscure, beyond the obvious occult ones that are repeated in the various books that have been published over the years. There's a lot about her life that isn't that well known, or isn't really in the public domain. So I set about writing the book I wanted to read, I guess.
I'm familiar with the image that you mention at the beginning of your book, the one where she's standing with the seal over her chest, and she's standing in front of an altar.
Seal drawn on her chest.
It was a fascinating image for me when I was first getting interested in magic and the occult as well, because I think it was one of the first ever images related to Thelema or even magic that I can remember. So I completely understand your feeling.
It's an image that's used over and over in a lot of mm-hmm. a lot of not just Thelemic and Crowley books, but a lot of books on the sort of development of occultism in the early 20th century. It's one of those go-to images that publishers seem to like to use. So it's become quite an iconic image, I think, and it's almost she's become through that image a lot bigger than what she actually was. But we'll talk about her more and her actual significance and the role she played in Thelema as we progress, I'm sure.
So let's talk about Layla's early years. So what do you think that it was that set her on her path?
Okay, well, she started learning violin when she was very young, and her early life in Australia before she set off for England was very much dominated by music rather than anything esoteric. She played extensively in Australia, particularly around Sydney, and she did various tours of Australia as well, and earned quite a reputation for herself as a musician. And although we know quite a lot, although I've been able to uncover quite a lot about her movements in Australia in this period, due to the fact that the Australian media covered her activities quite extensively, she was a bit of a pet figure in the Australian media at the time, and they liked following her various tours and concerts and the things that she was doing. So although we know a lot about sort of where she was and what she was doing, we don't know a tremendous amount about what she actually thought or what she felt, because none of that is really covered, and we can only really guess it from her actions. It's one thing that would have made my job a lot easier when I was writing this book is if there'd been some kind of diary or journal or anything in her own words detailing what she was doing and how she felt about it. But unfortunately, there isn't. There are a couple of letters and there are a couple of interviews from the 1920s in the for Australian newspapers and magazines. But that's all we really have in her own words, which is quite weird. So as I was writing the book, I was very much reconstructing her life through sources that weren't directly related to her. It was almost a third person reconstruction of somebody's life, if you like.
Given that you had one hand tied behind your back in that regard, you set the tone and the scene of her early life really well, I think. I think the bit that stood out to me the most really was she had quite a large family.
She had 11 siblings.
Yeah, and one of her sisters had a tragic end.
Yeah, one of her sisters was killed in a horse riding accident when she was very young. That's one of those things that no doubt had a very big impact and effect on Layla when she was young. But it's not something she ever spoke about or ever gave her own opinions or feelings on. So again, we can only really guess at what she was thinking or feeling for the most part from what she was doing and the things that were happening to her. There are a couple of cases where she does give opinions, and we'll talk about those as we progress. But
so what was it that made her leave Australia in the first place and head to the UK?
She was offered a gig as a touring musician with a musical troupe called the Viennese Ladies Orchestra that she was leader of, and it was a tour of England, of the British Isles, so Scotland included, and Wales included. She came over for that. It was effectively in her capacity as a professional touring musician that she left Australia, but in the end she didn't actually go back permanently for another 16 years. It wasn't until 1924 that she actually returned to Australia for good. She spent the next 16 years of her life basically touring and performing And managed to get embroiled with Aleister Crowley along the way as well. So,
Despite Crowley's later harsh words about her being a fifth-rate fiddler, Layla was actually an incredibly accomplished violinist, perhaps one of the most accomplished female violinists of her entire era. She initially learned to play by ear, is that correct?
she did, yeah. She did initially, and this actually caused great frustration amongst her early tutors because when she had her very first violin tutor, she was effectively copying him as the Australian media put it at the time, parrot fashion, effectively following his hand movements and learning to play that way. And then she got a new tutor who tried to teach her using written music, which she just couldn't do at all. So he had to take her all the way back to the beginning effect and in effect, and to teach her how to.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously, your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
How to play by reading music. And yeah, it was probably for the best in the long run in terms of how her playing developed. But she was taken back to square one by her second tutor.
And in Australia, she won multiple awards and accolades, and there was a lot of newspaper articles that you include in the book about how essentially she was. You already mentioned it a little, I think, but the media really loved her. She was sort of an Australian darling.
The media, in particularly around Sydney, absolutely loved her, and they loved writing about her. And almost every little concert she did, and even a lot of the bigger concerts she did, the Australian media were there, writing about it and singing her praises. So, and at one point, she was even acclaimed the Queen of Australian Violinists,
That's it.
which is a quote in the book, which was actually a British a British journalist that coined that term and used it for her rather than an Australian one. But the Australian press coverage was just as enthusiastic about her talents.
And was that reflected in the UK as well? Was she also given the same sort of recognition there?
She was, yeah. It, as I say, the what the it was a local Bournemouth journalist who for a Bournemouth Echo, I think it was, the local Bournemouth newspaper in 1910, who described her as the Queen of Australian violinists. And it's funny because if you read Crowley's autobiography, he's quite dismissive of her musical talents, as you mentioned, and does describe her as a fifth-rate fiddler. But all of the other accounts we have of the quality of her playing speak about how good she was, and say that she was a very accomplished, very talented musician. So depends who you want to believe, I guess.
Did Crowley write that after their relationship?
He did,
Yeah,
yeah.
right. He was rather misogynistic and cruel, I think, is maybe the right word to use in regard to many of the women and most people in his life, I think.
Well, Crowley, yeah, he did have some very misogynistic views, and I think, however progressive and forward-thinking in a lot of respects people now think he was, and he was. He was also very much a product of his time in a lot of respects, and held quite a few views that I think would be rightly considered unacceptable these days. For example, there's a passage in Confessions of Alistair Crowley, his biography, which I quote in the book, where he talks about hitting his wife in order to make her behave herself, as if it was the most normal and natural thing in the world to do. And he was also very vocal in Confessions as to how inferior to men he thought women were. And with Layla in particular, although his biography, Confessions of Alistair Crowley, does cover the period that they were together in great detail, she's barely mentioned in it. And the majority of the mentions that she does get are negative or critical. Like, for example, the him describing her as a fifth-rate, or dismissing her talent as her being a fifth-rate fiddler. And you've at one point he compares her to a wombat due to her being from Australia. And he's critical of her intelligence, her career ambitions.
Her accent at one point.
Criticizes her accent. He takes credit for a musical project of hers, which he says was all his idea in the first place.
Which is a bit rich, really, because I don't know if you've ever heard the recordings of Aleister Crowley's voice.
I have, yes.
I think that's... yeah, I think maybe he's just a little full of himself.
I think he was quite bitter and biased at that point. It was after they separated, and they'd had an 8-year relationship, which I think
was quite long for Crowley.
It was actually his longest relationship, as far as I know. It was longer than he was with his wife Rose, and longer than he was with the other very significant woman in his life, which was Leah Hersig, who he's was with for much of the 1920s. His relationship with Layla outlived both of those two. So as far as to my knowledge, it's the longest single relationship with one woman that Crowley had. Not that he was in any way faithful to her, or, you know, there are an awful lot of other women and men too came and went in his life in the period he was with her, but she was his longest relationship that I'm aware of.
And you write that you believe it was her time in London when she first encountered Aleister Crowley.
We think that she met Crowley in the Café Royal in London in the spring of 1910. But that is unconfirmed. It's the suspicion of most Crowley scholars that is where they met. Café Royal was something of a bohemian hangout in London at the time, and Crowley was a regular there. And in effect, anyone who was anyone in London at the time was a regular at the Café Royal, including people like Oscar Wilde and W.B. Yeats, the author, Aubrey Beardsley, the artist, Walter Sickert, George Bernard Shaw, etc., etc. And Layla was introduced to that scene by Catherine Mansfield, who was a writer from New Zealand who was friends with Layla at the time and who Layla met in London. Mansfield had also recently moved to London from New Zealand. And Layla had befriended her, and that it was through Catherine Mansfield that Layla was introduced to the bohemian scene in London. And as far as we're aware, that was how she met Crowley.
So wasn't it Mansfield that makes that quote about not being romantically involved? Layla expresses some kind of surprise that Mansfield isn't involved with Crowley in some way, and she makes some comment about how she's not his lover and she hasn't lent him money or something. What was the quote?
I know the quote you mean. It's it wasn't from Catherine Mansfield. Although actually Catherine Mansfield did meet Crowley and was not impressed with him at all, describing him as a, quote, pretentious and very dirty fellow. Mansfield was not impressed with Crowley at all. But the quote you're thinking of is actually from Gwendolyn Otter, who was quite a bohemian and socialite in London at the time, talking to a chap named Victor Newberg, who was a occultist and friend of Crowley's. Victor Newberg expressed surprise to Gwendolyn Otter that she'd never been hurt by Crowley because people tended to be. Gwendolyn Otto replied along the lines of, well, how could Crowley hurt me? I'm not in love with him and I've never lent him any money.
That's it.
So I think that's the quote you're thinking of.
That's a fantastic quote. I really like that. You mentioned that they were all meeting at this cafe. Forgive me,
the Cafe Royale.
Write quite a bit about this, and you really set a wonderful scene. There's this one specific scene I remember you in the book, where Crowley throws some huge party there, and then it's at the period of his life, I think, when he was absolutely broke, and at the end of the party, he just very quietly disappears from the party and
pretended to go to the toilet and slipped out. That's one. Yeah, that was that wasn't until much later. That wasn't until the 30s, long after his Layla days, when he was living in poverty. And yes, the story goes that he racked up this enormous bill at the Cafe Royal and slipped out without paying. After which, he wasn't welcome in the place anymore.
And was this the same place where he used to go to be invisible?
There is a story, it may be an apocryphal story, we don't know exactly how true it is, that Crowley had this magical technique of invisibility that he was practicing around about this period, whereby he reckoned it was more through the art of distraction and disguise. He reckoned he could render himself invisible. And he developed a habit of turning up in public, including at the Cafe Royal, in full ritual magical regalia. The fact that people didn't pay much attention to him, he attributed to his skills at invisibility. And as I say, there is a story, which may be an apocryphal story, that one of the guests at the Cafe Royal asked one of the waiters who Crowley was and why he was dressed in the fashion he was dressed, and was told, don't worry about it, that's just Mr. Crowley being invisible.
Yeah, wonderful. So in this, during this period of time when Crowley was hanging out at the Cafe Royale at the time, was Layla with him for a significant part of that time as well?
There was overlap. As I say, we think they met in the Cafe Royale. And at the time, she was in England and in London, in the midst of this tour that we mentioned with the Viennese Ladies Orchestra. That was the reason she was in London. As I mentioned, she befriended Catherine Mansfield, and they were spending a lot of time together on nights when Layla didn't have a gig. Going to a lot of shows, a lot of concerts, and a lot of arts events around London. And that was how they met. And very frustratingly, although Crowley mentions that he and Layla met in the spring of 1910, in Confessions, he doesn't actually say where it was or precisely when. As I say, it's commonly reckoned to have been at the Cafe Royal, except for one Crowley scholar, a chap named Martin Booth, who claims that they may have met in Paris, although Booth, who is now deceased, doesn't provide a source for this. I'm not sure where he got this information from.
How frustrating.
It's very frustrating. If he was still alive, I would have pinged him an email and asked him about it, but obviously I was unable to do that. The one thing that would have made my job an awful lot easier when writing this book is if Layla had left some kind of diary or notebook, but there isn't one. So I was having to rely very much on other people's accounts to try to pull together exactly what she was doing and where and when. And for her London years with Crowley in particular, unfortunately, the majority of accounts we have are from Crowley. There are some media accounts and some other accounts, but a lot of the information from that period about what she was doing, where and when and with whom, does come from Crowley's writing. So which inevitably there may, as I suspect, be a certain bias there. because I don't think they parted on the most on the friendliest of terms. If the account that he gives of her in Confessions is anything to go by.
It was very soon after they met that she was initiated into the AA.
It was. That was April 1910. Actually, first of April 1910, he initiated her. Her certificate does survive. There's a reproduction of it in the book. And though this may sound impressive, Crowley did have a habit of initiating whichever woman he was sleeping with at the time into whichever magical order was the most important to him at the time. So it wasn't as if he met her and saw great promise in her and thought that he had to initiate her immediately. It was just what he did with the women and other characters in his life as when he met them. I mean, Layla was very much a probationer in the AA, and she didn't, to my knowledge, evolve much further than that in terms of the AA degree structure, and also didn't devote a great deal of time or study to it, as far as we're aware.
He was pretty busy with more important things on her part, I think.
He was busy with other things, and the majority of magical activities that we do know she was involved in were primarily performance related, which I'm sure we'll go on to discuss.
Well, yeah, actually, it was during this time, they're in London. She's essentially at the height of her fame. As you mentioned, she's referred to as the Queen of Australian Violinists, and she was a total star across the continent at this point. It was very soon after they met and she was initiated into the AA that they performed what is now known as the Bartzable Working, which is reprinted in.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously, your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
In full, I think, at the back of Liber 418, The Vision and the Voice.
There is a transcript of it, yeah. It's in one of the equinoxes as well.
I've read that many times, but I've never been able to place it in its overall, like, historical...
the context.
And so, yeah. Like, reading your book gave me that context so I could understand exactly what was going on behind the scenes and why that came to be, and I just thought that was absolutely wonderful. But could you explain a little bit about how that Bartzable Working went down and what was Layla's role in that?
Okay, well, Crowley actually later hailed the Bartzable Working as one of the most potent or important rituals he'd been involved in over the years. It took place at the home of an occultist friend of his named Guy Marston, and involved Crowley, Layla Waddle, Guy Marston, and a chap named Victor Newberg, who was another occultist on the AA and London scene at the time, who he's now one of those people who was quite a significant figure in Crowley's life for a while, but later got sidelined effectively after the two fell out, and Crowley underplayed or downplayed his significance and his role in a lot of things. And in the account of the Bartzable Working that Crowley gives in Confessions of Alistair Crowley, he doesn't mention Victor Newberg being there at all, although Victor Newberg was there, because he's mentioned in the transcript, which is in which, as you mentioned, is in a Crowley book, and I think it was also featured in one of the issues of the Equinox. I don't quite recall which one now, but one of the issues of the Equinox has a transcript of it as well. And this ritual, it involved the summoning of an entity named Barzabel, which was associated with Mars in a lot of ways. Has a very, very warlike qualities. That's Mars in terms of Mars's occult and magical associations, rather than the planet Mars. So they summon this thing, which, as far as I can gather from the transcript, was summoned into Victor Newberg. He was in effect possessed by this entity, and Crowley and Guy Marston quizzed it, asking it various questions about this and that they wanted to know. And while all this was going on, Layla was soundtracking proceedings on violin, basically effectively providing an improvised musical soundtrack to this ritual as it was unfolding. And this inspired what later became known as the Rite of Artemis, which was a public ritual that they did, and then led on to the Rites of Eleusis, which are much better known, which obviously we can talk about if you want to.
So yes, so it was this ritual which essentially formed their relationship in a way of Crowley essentially started to depend on Layla for her musical quality, her musical skill in ritual settings. And it was very soon after this that they put together, as you just said, the Artemis ritual. And this ritual was specifically interesting because it was put on as a live performance.
It was, yeah. The Rite of Artemis took place in London in 1910, and yeah, Crowley gives two accounts as to where the idea for the Rite of Artemis came from. In one of them, he suggests that it was the idea of Guy Marston, who'd been present at the Barzabel working, who found the use of ritual and music together very effective and thought that there was potential to develop it further. And there's another account that Crowley gives that's in which he says that the whole thing came out of an evening in Crowley's flat in Victoria in London, when Crowley was reading poetry aloud and Layla was playing violin to accompany it. And the various friends and people who were present with them at the time were so impressed by this and so swept up in it that Crowley thought that there was potential to take it further, and out of that they developed the Rite of Artemis. So we've got two quite different stories, and it depends which one you'd rather believe. And I personally suspect the Guy Marston account is the more accurate one.
More accurate, but again, there's always this case of
the story that's more impressive and the story that's probably more likely to have been true. And
I really enjoyed the scene that you set with them potentially on drugs in this London flat with all their on peyote with all their friends. Well, it wasn't just peyote too, because I'm confident that there was cocaine and many other things. Crowley was notorious for that as well, but it was specifically the peyote, and it was just the scene that you set with them, you know, essentially riffing off each other, doing poetry, doing performing live off the cuff music, and it just gave me this really amazing little window into that period of history that I really liked. And it set a tone for the reason why all these rituals were being put together, which I lacked previously. I'd never, if I'm going to be really honest, I've actually never read any of Crowley's autobiography, Crowley's biographies.
Okay.
But so this was really one of my first proper reads of a Crowley-ish biography. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. So it was very, 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 just a cool scene. I really enjoyed the scene that you set.
You mentioned drugs, and obviously Crowley, different drugs came and went in Crowley's life at different periods. And he used different drugs recreationally, struggled with some drugs, and with addictions to some drugs throughout his life. But the one that he was particularly passionate about at this point was peyote. Now, peyote, it should be probably be said that the use of peyote was not common at all in Europe at that point. Crowley did claim in, I think in one of his articles in the Equinox, I think it is, to have been the person responsible for first introducing peyote from America into Europe, which wasn't the case at all. That it had, there had been numerous other people who'd gone to America and tried it, and there were academic studies of it. There were people trying to, scientists in Germany trying to synthetically recreate it. There was a lot going on with the study of peyote at the time. But Crowley was probably one of the first people to extensively use it on a recreational basis in Europe. Because it's funny, when people tend to think of recreational use of psychoactive drugs, they think of Aldous Huxley in the 50s and his mescaline experiments in Laws of Perception, or they think of whole LSD scene in the 60s, that kind of thing. And they don't realize that Crowley and his friends were doing it all 40 or 50 years earlier in London.
Yeah, and peyote is not a, it's not a forgiving substance. It's quite, yeah, it's very strong psychedelic.
Not one that I've tried personally, but I've heard it's it can be quite unrelenting.
So we've got this scene. They've met, they've become enamored with one another through music and verse, and they've performed this grand magical ritual. And then they move on to this live performance, the rites of Artemis, and they spike the audience's fruit juice or punch with the peyote.
I know where you're going with this. Yeah. Basically, the rite of Artemis was, just to set the scene, it was basically a performance ritual, staged and very theatrical, done in full ritual regalia in Crowley's flat in Victoria in London. And in large part, it was intended to be a promotional event, as well as public performance and spectacle. It was intended to be promotional, presenting the ideas of AA and Thelema to a public audience. Now, the idea of public ritual or public occult ritual wasn't unique to Crowley, and it wasn't something new. There are other people who'd done it before him, and Layla's involvement in it was primarily a musical one, in that she was soundtracking what was going on with her violin, although she did have a role in the ritual as well as a figure known as the Mother of Heaven, and she was fully robed as well as she was playing violin, and there are some surviving photographs of Layla in full AA robes playing violin. They were taken in a London studio. They weren't taken at the Rite of Artemis, but we do have photographs of her, so we've got a very clear idea of what she looked like. And so yes, they did have this invite, they did have this audience there, and the story does go that they passed around this fruit punch at regular intervals throughout the evening, which apparently was laced with peyote and possibly opium as well. So and unsurprisingly, the audience do report being completely swept up in this sense of wonder and rapture at what was going on stage. But obviously how much that had to do with the fact that they were spiked with peyote is anybody's guess, really, and how much it had to do with Crowley's skills as a performance occultist.
So this gets an incredibly positive review from everyone who joined. And because it was a public thing, people came to actually review it.
Okay, well, you had, as I say, you had the Rite of Artemis, and then you subsequently had the Rites of Eleusis. And the Rite of Artemis was primarily in front of an invited audience. They were people who knew Crowley. They weren't just selling tickets in the street. It was people who knew Crowley and who were familiar with what Crowley was doing. It was very much an invited audience. And from that, they evolved the idea of doing the Rites of Eleusis, which was a similar series of ritual performances. There were seven of them altogether, which were done before a paying public audience in in a venue in London. And Rites of Eleusis were, as you rightly say, the Rite of Artemis was very enthusiastically reviewed by various people, and those reviews found their way into newspapers and the like. The rites of Eleusis, although they were structurally very similar to the rite of Artemis, the audience reaction was nowhere near as positive as it was to the rite of Artemis. I don't know if that had something to do with the fact that they had no peyote laced punch going round, or what. I mean, Crowley attributes the relative lack of success of the whole rites of Eleusis to the fact that it was kind of thrown together at the last minute, as opposed to the careful preparation that went into the rite of Artemis. So maybe that had something to do with it as well.
One of Crowley's many enemies goes to see the rites of Eleusis. Well, I say enemies, somebody who essentially followed Crowley around. I think he was the individual who actually coined the phrase wickedest man in the world. And so he arrives to watch the rites of Eleusis and makes all these complaints, and it's not so good. I think that the fact that they began the rites of Eleusis with Saturn, which is the slowest, most ponderous and dour and morbid of all of the seven spheres, may have played some role
possibly,
in it.
Possibly. I mean, the audience do report that some of the rites of Eleusis were quite monotonous and boring in some respects. I mean, these performances did go on for several hours. It wasn't just a half an hour or an hour event. Some of these would go on for 2 hours or more, some of these public rites. So and people paid to sit and watch this, and apparently they were sitting on these very uncomfortable rows of wooden benches for several hours watching this. And opposed to the rite of Artemis, it was nowhere near as successful or as well received an event. And the journalist that you're thinking of, it was a magazine called the John Bull, who took a particular exception to Crowley and a particular dislike to Crowley. And it was a journalist at the John Bull who later coined the phrase wickedest man in the world, which people still apply to Crowley all these years later. It was the John Bull that initially called him the wickedest man in the world in response to events at the temple at Cephalu, the temple of Thamer at Cephalu, which beyond what we're going to be talking about today. But that was where it all came from in the early 1920s.
So what does he have to say about Layla's performance?
This is, there's a quote from Confessions, which is in the book. And this is the point at which Crowley says that Layla was, in effect, a fifth-rate fiddler, and that when she met him, or when he met her, she had little in the way of musical ability, but that through his magical guidance and tuition, she blossomed and became this amazing musician that charmed everybody.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously, your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
With the skill of her playing, and that in effect it was all down to his own his magical influence that made that happen. We discussed Victor Newberg, or we touched on Victor Newberg earlier, and he does a very similar thing with Victor Newberg, effectively saying that Victor Newberg was a very substandard poet when Crowley met him, and through Crowley's influence and guidance became this wonderful poet. And as soon as they fell out, he became a bad poet again. That's right of Artemis. And it was the John Bull that which I think is what you're thinking of, that took exception to Crowley and wrote these very scathing reviews of the rites of Eleusis. And As I say, all in all, it was a very unsuccessful operation compared to the Rite of Artemis.
So the news from the UK reaches Australia of Layla being involved in these secret, esoteric, and occult rituals. And how does the media in Sydney and the rest of Australia react?
Obviously, Layla was still a very highly regarded figure in Australia, particularly around Sydney, and in the town that she was from, which is a little town outside of Sydney named Bathurst. And she was very highly regarded, and everybody, as we mentioned, the Australian media were following her very closely, and every little thing that she did and every gig she did and everything, they would cover. And they even covered her, or they make mention of her her tour of England and the various dates that she was doing. And they pick up on the fact that she was suddenly involved in this occult group in London and undertaking these performances. And the photographs of her with her violin in full ritual garb actually appeared in Australian media, in newspaper articles. And they seem to still have a great fondness for her if you read these articles, and they're not in any way critical or scathing or in any way dismissive of her. They're just reporting this is what she was doing, because obviously the esoteric and occult and particular spiritualism in particular, that kind of thing was very big in London in particular, but in the West at the time. And I don't want to use the word fashionable, but it wasn't regarded as a prank or kook interest in the same way that in a lot of respects it is today. And the Australian media did write about her and reproduce the photos. There's even newspapers in America that picked it up. So it was quite widely reported, the Rite of Artemis in particular, less so the Rites of Eleusis. So I don't know if they had a good promoter or publicist or somebody who was putting the word out about this stuff. But let's say the Australian media, even whatever she was doing, they if word of it got back to Australia, one or another Australian newspaper would run a little article by saying this is what Layla Waddle is up to these days. So she was a bit of a darling of the Australian media at the time. They loved her.
I especially enjoyed all of the various newspaper articles and reviews which unfold throughout your book describing the events of Layla's life. But like collectively, they produce a form of pluralistic narrative, like an unreliable narrator. And you've mentioned that before, like who's story, you know, would you rather believe, which is more likely, in that it leaves the reader to like having to find the middle ground and fill in the blanks in the story. And I really appreciate that. I really enjoyed that part of the way in which you structured the story, you structured the historical events, and you wove it together really well. I think that, yeah, you quite excellently crafted this. But how did you go about finding all of these disparate publications? Because some of them go back as far as the 19th century.
Online newspaper archives is the short answer. The newspaper archives for Australia in the 19th and early 20th century were an absolute treasure trove in a lot of respects, and they really helped fill out a lot of the details of her life, especially her life in Australia. I must admit, the newspaper archive or the newspaper coverage for her years in England and in America was nowhere near as extensive in comparison, which is unfortunate. So for that those areas of her life, I was having to draw from other sources. But it's funny, if I'd have written this book 20 or 30 years ago, I'd have had to have physically got on a plane and flown to Australia and gone to this archive building and gone through physical newspapers or microfiche articles and the like. But thanks to the wonders of modern technology and the internet, I was able to do the whole thing sat on my sofa on my laptop in my flat. So it was brilliant. As I say, it was discovering that archive, especially for Australia, that opened things up a lot for me because there were I mean, all of the information was there in the public domain. It's just no, it was just pulling it all together and constructing a coherent narrative out of it was my job in a lot of respects. But say it's not necessarily that I was uncovering rare or completely unknown or completely new information. It's just that I just nobody had taken the time or the trouble to do it before, really, I don't think.
Well, I think what you've produced is wonderful. You must have some skills that you've carried over from writing fiction to produce such an interesting narrative from often rather dry source material. So well done for crafting something so wonderful.
Yeah, it's a very different way of writing nonfiction to fiction, but at the same time, I was very keen to have a narrative arc, if you like, through the book, from her birth through all the way through her years in Australia to her life in London to her life then in America, to her then return to Australia and her early death. It was almost like there was already an existing narrative arc there that I could follow through and hang all of this information off of. It wasn't just a case of someone who'd led quite a mundane life and I was trying to piece it all together. She'd had a very interesting and exciting life in a lot of respects, and it was just finding the thread through it all, and that was the job really for me.
What do you think then ultimately is Layla's overarching influence on Thelema as it stands today?
That's an interesting question. Is it worth briefly discussing what Thelema is for any listeners who aren't familiar with it?
For those who are our listeners who might not be, yeah, sure.
It's quite a colourful story. It's Crowley says that in 1904, when he was in Egypt with his then wife Rose, he was contacted by an entity calling itself Aiwass, who transmitted or channeled through him a text over 3 days, calling a text which became known as the Book of the Law, which is the central text of Thelema. And Thelema is effectively a belief system or religion for a new aeon, if you like. It's a sort of religion for the 20th century and beyond. And Crowley spent a lot of his life after this, after he'd received this text, much of his life was spent trying to understand it and figure out what it all meant. And the most famed Thelemic maxims, which are lines from the Book of the Law, are obviously every man and every woman is a star. And love is the law, love under will, and the one that everyone knows, which is do what thou wilt, shall be the whole of the law, which are the essential essence of Thelema, if you like. Now, contrary to popular belief, do what thou wilt doesn't mean do whatever the hell you want. It's a lot more complicated and sort of nuanced than that. It's rather a case of finding your true will in the world and living in accordance with it. One of the central ideas of Thelema is that every individual has their what Crowley calls their true will or purpose, and that through magical means or otherwise, one should uncover it and live in accordance with it. Thelema is actually a lot more focused than people give it credit for. It's very much a cult of the individual rather than just wild hedonism for the sake of it, which is how I think a lot of people perceive it. As for Layla's significance in Thelema, she was the first woman to attain the ninth degree in the Ordo Templi Orientis, which was an order that Crowley was involved in later in life after the AA. She was also the first woman to perform in the Gnostic Mass, which is one of the central rituals of Thelema. But in terms of her wider significance to Thelema and occultism, I'm not sure, because her primary interest in life always seemed to me, the more I learned about her, to be more in music and in the arts than it was in magic or the esoteric. There's a quote from a guy called James Laver, who was another figure on the London bohemian scene at the time, and friends with Crowley and friends with Catherine Mansfield and Gwendolyn Osler and all these other people that we've touched upon today. And James Laver overheard this conversation between Layla and Catherine, sorry, and Gwendolyn Otter, where Layla says that Crowley has basically asked her to devote her life to magic and that she doesn't want to. And I think that this was something of a frustration for Crowley, because pretty much every other woman in his life, and there were a lot of women in Crowley's life, pretty much every other woman he got involved with did devote themselves to him and to magic, forsaking everything else. And Layla didn't. She remained a very independent-minded woman with her own career and her own interests throughout their relationship. And while Crowley was doing his magic, she was off on tour or doing this gig or that show or.
Some might say that she was doing her true will.
Exactly, she was. She was already doing her true will when Crowley met her, and she continued to do so. Again, it's in the book, but it goes back to what we were saying earlier about Crowley leaving this long trail of ruined women in his wake, and how so many of the women, he would ask them to devote themselves to him and to magic, and they would. And then 2 years or 5 years, however long later, they would end up a complete wreck in an asylum after he dumped them and moved on to the next woman. And so he left this long trail of wrecked women behind him, except for Layla. She's the only woman, as far as I can tell,
Who survived it?
who survived him, who didn't come out of a relationship with Crowley, either an alcoholic or in an asylum or suicidal.
It's just terrible. But yeah,
And I think the reason for that is because she was very much her own person with her. She was a very independent spirit with her own interests and her own career that she pursued and that she wasn't prepared to give up for him. Crowley did not consider Layla to be a Scarlet Woman.
Oh, really? Right.
I think she should have been, but Crowley,
Oh.
when he presents his lists of women in his life that he does not, that he considers to have been Scarlet Woman, Scarlet Women, she is not on any of those lists. He does not consider
Because
her to have been Scarlet Woman.
she didn't devote herself to him like the others did.
I think so, and because she wasn't so involved on the ritual side of things, she wasn't so devoted to magic. Some of the women that he does cite as having been Scarlet Women, the reasons he gives is that, they were poetically and magically inspirational to him, which Layla was in spades as well. So she should have been a Scarlet Woman. I think he was very bitter about her when they broke up, and that there was a resentment there, that which is why he is so belittling and disparaging of her in confessions.
So what was it that had them part ways?
It's not really known. They were definitely a couple up until 1916, and then they kind of drifted apart. They were both in America at the time, both living in New York. She was off doing her concerts. He was off traveling around America, doing all sorts of magical this and magical that. And every now and again, they get together in New York. And he was involved in editing a journal at the time as well, called there was the Fatherland, and there was the other one that he was editing. That she there's these two journals that he was editing, arts journals, and she wrote articles for them. So they were definitely still on good terms until 1917. And then at the end of 1917, he writes is his final love poem that he writes to her, which is called A Septennial, in celebration of 7 years, 7 years of their relationship. And that's the last thing that he writes about her. And the text of it is actually in my book. And the passion with which he wrote about her in the earlier poems is barely there. And then there's a meeting with what's his name? Seagrave. That was it, William Seagrave. In 1918, Crowley befriends this journalist, William Seagrave, and basically gives him the whole spiel about magic and Thelema and everything. And Seagrave turns out this very positive, very pro-Crowley article. But in the process, Seagrave also meets Layla through Crowley. So in 1918, they were certainly still on good terms. And she wrote another couple of articles for his journal that he was editing in 1918 as well. And then all of a sudden, there's nothing and they separate. And it's not known exactly why or exactly when, but just because neither of them spoke about it and neither of them wrote about it, Crowley makes no mention of it at all in the Confessions, despite the fact that he writes. There's other women who were a lot less significant in his life that he writes in a great deal more detail about in Confessions. And as I mentioned, pretty much all of the mentions of Layla in Confessions are critical. I love the bit when he compares her to a wombat. He says her something to do with her ancestry. I can't remember the exact wording of the quote. It's in the book, but yeah, he does invoke the spirit of the wombat in discussing her Australian ancestry.
Oh, that's
It's
terrible.
remarkable, remarkable. Yeah, that's the other thing with Crowley. He was quite racist in a lot of respects as well. And again, this goes back to what we were saying about his attitudes towards women being very much of their time. No matter how progressive and forward-thinking people like to think he was still very much a middle-class Victorian gentleman in a lot of respects. And as to why it's taken so long for someone to write a book about her, I'm really not sure because I'd been thinking about doing it for a while before I actually started writing it, and it had always perplexed me why nobody had actually done it before. And as I say, all the information there that I draw on in the book was already in the public domain, albeit some of it was spread quite far and wide in some respects, especially for years in Australia. But it's funny because although she's perceived as something of an iconic figure in 20th century occultism, it's surprising how few details of her life we actually knew. So yeah, maybe music was Layla doing her true will, and in that respect, she was a lot more occult and magical than we think.
But Layla does have some influence on the lasting, how would I put it, the lasting works of Crowley, because she features quite heavily in the Book of Lies.
She does, yeah. Book of Lies was written by a book that Crowley wrote in the spring of 1912. It's a very odd book in a lot of respects. I don't know if you've read it, but it's a book that can be read on quite a few different levels. It's basically 93 very short texts, obviously 93 being a number of great significance to Thelema. And some of these texts are only a couple of words, and the longest is just under a page long. And Crowley reckons that if properly studied, it contains an awful lot of esoteric and occult secrets in disguised form, with a lot of word games and metaphors and double meanings and all sorts for the reader to decipher in order for for all these hidden secrets to be revealed to them. So you can read it on that level, but on another level, you can very much read it as this extended love song to Layla Waddle. in a way, because a lot of the texts are about her, or they mention her, or he sings her praises in them. It's almost like an extended love song to her. I mean, he did write a lot of other poetry, in particular, some short stories, but poetry in particular, throughout his life about or dedicated to her. But for me, the real core of it and the best of it is to be found in the Book of Lies. And as we mentioned, and we did mention Confessions already, it's quite remarkable that, throughout, or between the years 1910 and 1917, he was churning out all this very passionate love poetry about her. But 10 years later, by the time he was writing Confessions, which covers the period that they were together in great depth, he barely mentions her. And as we mentioned, he criticizes her talent on violin and her intelligence, her accent, her career ambitions, and all sorts. So Confessions is, I think, a very bitter and biased portrayal of her. And I think if you want how Crowley truly felt about her, you're a lot better off reading the Book of Lies.
So we've not covered everything in the book by a mile. There is still so much more that we could talk about, but I think it's best that we leave it for the readers to discover. Without going into too much more detail, is there any one part of Layla's story that particularly resonated with you as her biographer?
It's very much, as we said, her independence and her passion and her spirit and her dedication to her art and to her music. And as we mentioned a few times, she was this very independent-minded woman at the turn of the 20th century, pursuing a career that she was very successful in, which, in some respects, her being a woman at the turn of the 20th century doing that is quite remarkable. And that was one thing that always stayed. I mean, she was traveling around the world doing concerts and giving performances, and as I say, for a woman at the turn of the century doing that, sadly, does seem quite remarkable in a lot of respects. And that was one thing that always stayed with me. And I did find that the more I wrote about her, and the more I learned about her, and the more I researched about her, the more I liked her, I think. And I think I can imagine if I did meet her, she would have been a very pleasant and entertaining and amiable company, which she was, according to everybody who met her. They always say how charming and delightful a conversationalist she was as well, because there are several interviews which we won't go into, but they do cover them in the book that she gave for Australian media in the 1920s. A couple of as a newspaper and a magazine that interviewed her, discussing her life, although they didn't discuss any of the occult or esoteric stuff. It was more the musical stuff that they were talking about, and they do remark on what delightful and charming company and conversation she was. So,
So finally, is there anything that you're working on at the moment? Perhaps something else that you're currently obsessed with?
I've always got at least one or another project on the go, whether it's a book or an album or one thing or another. I work in different media, and as for what's next now, I think once we've got the promotional work for this book out of the way. And in that respect, I should perhaps mention that the launch of the book is at Watkins Bookshop in London on the 1st of August, the evening of the 1st of August, which I will be appearing, and I'll probably be doing a presentation about Layla and maybe doing a reading from the book as well. Not entirely sure what form it will take yet, but that's when the launch of the book is. But yeah, as for what's next for me, I've always got one thing or another on the go. I'm working on another spoken word album at the moment with a friend of mine, which has got voice and text by me and music by him. As I mentioned, I've done various spoken word with music albums in the past, and I've always done the music myself before. But for this one, I thought it would be interesting to get somebody else in on the musical side of things and see where it goes and how it develops. So I'm going to be doing that. I've got another novel on the go as well. As I mentioned, fiction was always very much my passion in the past and was always what I wrote. But now that the Layla book is out of the way, I do definitely want to do more non-fiction as well. I do have a few ideas in mind, but nothing specifically in progress yet, just ideas I'm developing. It did occur to me that I would have liked to have written something about Leia Hersig, who was another very significant woman in Crowley's life in the 1920s mainly, and another figure that I've always found fascinating. But I'm probably not going to do that, partly because there'd be a bit too much overlap with the Layla book, and partly because I do cover Leia Hersig to an extent in the Layla book. She does get a mention, and I do briefly discuss her life with Crowley. So I'll let someone else write that one, I think.
And so do you have any presence online for those of our audience who might be interested in keeping up to date with you and your work?
I do. I've got the usual social media, although I'm not that active on social media. I'm Instagram to an extent, Threads to an extent, Facebook not very much. Probably the best place to find out more about me is my website, which is darrenfrancis.co.uk. And if you go to that, then links to all my social media, if you want to follow me on social media, are on my website. And there's also full information about the various albums I've done and the various books I've written. And a lot of information about the Layla book as well will be on there. I haven't quite updated it yet, but we're waiting. But I will be very shortly with full details of the Layla book and maybe a bit of behind the scenes information about the writing of it as well that isn't in the book. So yeah, if you want to find out more about me, that is the best place to go.
Excellent. Well, I will include links to all of your social media and your website, etc., in the description at the bottom of this video. Darren, thank you so much for coming onto the show today. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Oh, you are very welcome. I've enjoyed it very much. Thanks for having me.
That was Darren Francis, author of Layla, The Life of Layla Waddle, the first biography of the Queen of Australian Violinists, now available from Haydian Press. Darren's book excels in its execution of capturing not only the details of Layla's life, but in stringing together the various historical records which survive into a living, pluralistic narrative. While it seems unfortunate that Crowley is left to have the last word on Layla in his confessions, given his obvious bitterness and resentment, with Darren's book we are left far better positioned to make more refined judgments on the actual events of her life. Given Darren was working with one hand tied behind his back in fully capturing Layla's lived experience, his devotion to the details and astute reading between the lines allows for a far more fleshed out rendition of the events of her life and presents her as a highly capable and exceptionally talented musician who was already walking her own path towards her true will far before she met the wickedest man in the world. A highly recommended read for those interested in the history of Thelema and with the social scenes of London, Europe, and America in the 1910s and 20s. I really look forward to covering more from Darren in the future. Thank you so much for listening this far. We are always so grateful for your continued support of our podcast and of our books. Please take a moment to like, comment, and share our podcast. Every interaction really helps us and our ever-growing global authorship. Next month, I will be talking to Briar, author of The Beheading Game, discussing fairy lore, headlessness in Celtic culture, and the mysterious foreigner god, Cron. Until then, take care, and I will see you all again in the next one.